Our scripture reading this morning comes from Exodus, chapter 2, beginning with verse 11, through chapter 3, ending with verse 12. One day, after Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and saw their forced labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his kinfolk. He looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. When he went out the next day, he saw two Hebrews fighting, and he said to the one who was in the wrong, "Why do you strike your fellow Hebrew?" And he answered, "Who made you ruler and judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" And then Moses was afraid and thought, "Surely the thing is known." When Pharaoh heard of it, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh. He settled in the land of Midian and sat down by a well. The priest of Midian had 7 daughters. They came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's flocks. But some shepherds came and drove them away. Moses got up and came to their defense and watered their flock. When they returned to their father, he said, "How is it that you've come back so soon today?" And they said, "An Egyptian helped us against the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock." The father said to his daughters, "Where is he? Why did you leave the man? Invite him to break bread." Moses agreed to stay with the man, and he gave Moses his daughter Zipporah in marriage. She bore a son, and he named him Gershom, for he said, "I have been an alien, residing in a foreign land." After a long time, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned under their slavery and cried out. Out of their slavery they cried for help, and their cry rose to God. God heard their groaning, and God remembered God's covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God looked upon the Israelites, and God took notice of them. Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. He led his flock beyond the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There, the angel of the Lord appeared to him in the flame of fire out of a bush. He looked, and the bush was blazing, yet it was not consumed. And then Moses said, "I must turn aside and look at this great sight and see why the bush is not burned up." When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, "Moses, Moses." And Moses said, "Here I am." And then God said, "Come no closer. Remove the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground." And God said further, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob." And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Then the Lord said, "I have observed the misery of my people who are in Egypt. I've heard their cry on account of their taskmasters. Indeed, I know their suffering, and I've come down to deliver them from the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the country of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. The cry of the Israelites has now come to me. I've also seen how the Egyptians oppress them. So come, I will send you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." But Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?" And God said, "I will be with you, and this shall be a sign that it is I who sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God on this mountain." These are our sacred stories. Thanks be to God.
Good morning. I was honored when Laura asked me to be a part of your Sunday morning gathering. My family and I have nothing but great memories of being part of the Covenant community when we lived in Houston a few years ago. And I am delighted to be with you this morning, even if in this virtual mode. It's a pleasure to be able to share with you this morning. The title of my sermon will be The Fires of Justice in a World of Trouble. In his 1996 book, Between God and Gangsta Rap, the sociologist Michael Eric Dyson tells a story of an adolescent experience that would end up shaping his understanding of the world in profound ways. As a Black teenager living in inner city Detroit in the 1970s, Dyson was a curious and intellectually gifted young man. In his early teenage years, he had come under the mentorship of a woman in his neighborhood named Mrs. James, whom he describes as an extraordinarily demanding tutor who introduced him to a vast ocean of Black intellectual and cultural life. With Mrs. James, he read the poetry of Lawrence Dunbar, Langston Hughes, and Margaret Alexander Walker. He learned about the famous debates between W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington. He explored the exploits of old Black cowboys and the music of Bessie Smith and Louis Armstrong. "I was taught to believe," Dyson says, "that the same musical genius that animated Scott Joplin lighted as well on Stevie Wonder." This treasure trove of Black intellectual and artistic life was also met with another set of intellectual resources. After the death of a neighbor, a staunch Republican, as Dyson describes the unnamed man, he inherited a set of Harvard classics that, as it was described on the collection, represented the world's great literature. Here, Dyson absorbed Benjamin Franklin's autobiography, Abraham Lincoln's speeches, Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, the great works of Marcus Aurelius, John Milton, and Thomas Hobbes. Submersing himself in the thought of these giants of Western philosophy and literature, a whole new world was opened to him. Here, Dyson felt himself escaping his own social context of poverty and crime, quote, "beyond the buzz of bullets and whiplash of urban violence, and ascending into the world of elite and civilized learning." Dyson was on his way. He just had to keep his head down and stay the course. And then one day, the Harvard classics that had opened so much for him ended up leading him into danger. Inspired by the autobiography of Jean-Paul Sartre that he had been reading, he decided to go to the local corner store to buy a cigar in order to, as he puts it, get a whiff of the Parisian cafe life where the great existentialist philosopher had written his masterworks. But just as he approached the counter to purchase the cigar, he felt a hard jolt in his back. It was the barrel of a sawed-off shotgun. Its owner ordered Dyson and the other customers to the ground as the gunman and his partners robbed the store. Ripped from the fantasy of Parisian intellectual life, Dyson's material reality of poverty and violence came crashing back. Years later, reflecting on this brush with death, Dyson would write that, quote, "long before Marx and Gramsci would remind me, I understood that consciousness is shaped by the material realm, that learning takes place in a world of trouble." These days, trouble seems to be everywhere. We are now living through multiple crises. A new catastrophe seems to appear almost every day. I sense that your liturgy each Sunday must now include a list like this: COVID-19 and over 180,000 American deaths, with a global death toll approaching 1 million. An ongoing and accelerating climate crisis, an ever-widening wealth gap, a failed presidency, and a rapidly rising tide of neo-fascism and white supremacy. And then, of course, the names: Jacob Blake, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, the list goes on. We are living in truly troubling, dangerous times. We haven't chosen this world, but this is the world we've been given. And if we were somehow insulated from the trouble before, we've all learned it by now. In this morning's reading from the book of Exodus, Moses also has a learning experience. At this point in the narrative, Moses, who is Egyptian royalty as the adopted son of Pharaoh's daughter, he has seen the suffering of his people. He has seen their plight as slaves. He has seen a fellow Hebrew being beaten by an Egyptian slave driver, and in a fit of violent rage, he's ended up killing him. Having lived a life of royal luxury and comforts, Moses has suddenly found himself in a world of trouble. He tries to escape. After he kills the Egyptian slave driver, he flees to the land of Midian and starts over. He becomes a shepherd, settling in while rediscovering his Hebrew identity. And then, poor Moses, all he wanted to do was tend his sheep in peace. He finds himself talking to a burning bush. Fire is a major theme in the Bible. The God of Israel is described as a consuming fire. His wrath rains down as fire on the wicked. As the psalmist cries out, "How long will your wrath burn like fire, O Lord?" In the New Testament, while John the Baptist baptizes with water, Jesus, he proclaims, will baptize with the Holy Spirit and fire. Indeed, in the book of Acts, during the event of Pentecost, the Spirit is given as tongues of fire placed on the disciples' heads. Fire illumines. Fire destroys the old. It makes way for the new. In Deuteronomy, like in Exodus, God is also described as speaking from the midst of a fire. As it says, "You heard the sounds of words, but you saw no form." This formless fire also relates very closely to God as Yahweh, the name for the unnameable. God the unrepresentable, God the inconceivable. One way to think about such an understanding of God that paradoxically is based precisely on the impossibility of understanding God, what in the theological tradition is called apophaticism, is that God is another name for the possibility of justice, the impossible possibility of justice, the inconceivability of justice in an intrinsically unjust world. God, the consuming fire, God, the Holy Spirit, God, the justice that is to come, whatever you want to call it. It is that which cannot be grasped. It has no name, no pre-given form. It is simply unthinkable. This is a hard teaching. Like Moses, who hides his face in front of the burning bush because he can't bear to look at it, we tremble at the fact that, in ourselves, we cannot imagine this justice. We are incapable of conceiving a different world than the one we are given. We cannot see the arrival of justice coming from beyond the horizon. We try, but the world always seems to disappoint. Just like when the young Eric Dyson was violently thrust back into his world of trouble, right at the moment he thought he had figured out how to escape it, at every corner we are constantly reminded that whatever this world is, it is not just. Whatever this world is, it is not one where justice seems something that we should expect. For example, in this world, where the legacy and politics of white supremacy are so powerful and so deeply ingrained in virtually every fiber of American society, it is virtually impossible to expect that reparations for 300 years of slavery and another 150 years of systemic anti-Black racism would ever be given. It is virtually impossible to expect that Breonna Taylor's murderers would finally be arrested and convicted in a court of law. It is virtually impossible to expect that Martin Luther King Jr.'s aging dream of racial equality in the beloved community could ever fully be realized in this world. In the unforgettable conclusion of The Fire Next Time, written in 1963, the great American writer James Baldwin warned of the consequences of allowing America to go on in its racist status quos, of allowing the racial nightmare of American society to persist. Baldwin warns us that if we do not dare to change the world, to finally achieve our country, as he puts it, quote, "The fulfillment of that prophecy, recreated from the Bible in a song by a slave, is upon us. God gave Noah the rainbow sign, no more water. The fire next time." Baldwin knew well that when justice is always and everywhere deferred, when the intransigence and ignorance of the white world remains unaddressed and unchallenged, he knew well that the fire will come. And indeed, they have come once again here in America. Just as the city of Watts burned in 1965, or as Los Angeles did in 1992. Just as Harper's Ferry erupted in 1859, or as Nat Turner's uprising in Southampton, Virginia did in 1831. The fire, the same fire, has now come to Minneapolis, Kenosha, Atlanta, Portland, Rochester, and so many other American cities. How do we measure such eruptions? As Black Studies scholar Nahum Chandler asks of the LA riots, he says, "How can we speak of the massive violence that preceded what has been now called the rebellion or riots in the streets of Los Angeles? How can we speak of the violence, the catastrophe that is white supremacy? What lit this fire? What fuels this fire against it? An unjust society is a volatile society." These past few months have once again shown what happens when the promise of racial justice is deferred too long, when it is violently and brutally held back in every instance of police violence and arrogance, economic alienation, political disenfranchisement, and white complacency. The fires of a justice to come are being announced once again in the flames of an undomesticated, welled up, and from the comfort of the wealthy and white spaces of status quo American privilege, inconceivable spirit of protest and resistance. Whatever you may think of the particular modes through which the oppressed have sought their liberation, it is difficult to deny that such fires have come at a moment when, once more, all expectations of justice formed around the status quos of this world have been exhausted and disappointed. Just as Moses learned, the burning fire of God's justice, which will destroy this unjust world as it clears the space for a new one, a promised land of milk and honey, where justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. This fire is that which refuses any and every expectation that would attempt to control or fit into our limited experiences and perceptions about the arrival of justice. Justice burns away the given knowledge of this world. As the American poet Wallace Stevens once said, such fire expels us in our images. This is why, as Moses learned, it is not enough to simply understand. It is not enough to simply educate ourselves about the trouble. We can't escape by pretending that we can somehow avoid the mess we find ourselves in by merely having some knowledge about it. Moses' encounter with the burning bush comes after he has identified with his own people and has been awakened to the reality of their enslavement. He's been educated about the trouble. He's had his one-off moment of passion when he kills the Egyptian slave driver, but he has not yet fully embraced the solidarity and lifelong commitment of justice to which he will be called. In Baldwin's cutting phrase, he has not yet dared everything. It is only when he is confronted by the flame that the suffering of the Hebrew slaves is fully illumined. It is only then that he is compelled into a life committed to the liberation of the oppressed. Through the flame, God says, the cry of the Israelites has now come to me. I have also seen how the Egyptians oppressed them. So come, I will send you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. God calls Moses back to his people, back to the world of trouble. When Moses questions his ability to undertake such a task, God says, I will be with you. And so he goes. He takes the leap of faith back into the world of trouble. When Pharaoh refuses Moses' demand to let my people go, when Pharaoh doubles down on the status quo of brutality and unequal slavery, the fire is set. And this quite literally, as you recall, that one of the 10 plagues that God sends is the thunder and hail that is indeed accompanied by fire coming down upon the earth. And out of these flames, out of the destruction of a nation built on the back of slaves, expectations are shattered. The inconceivable happens. The Israelites are liberated in their exodus. What will happen in America? What is to come out of so much violence, so much pain, so much trouble? Will America avoid the fate of its own destruction or change its course towards justice? The fire this time is shaking its foundations to the core. If we have the ears to hear, we might hear that God is speaking in the whirlwind, calling us back into the possibility of a justice that will only come when this world of trouble is confronted head on. For a lot of us, especially white folks, our instinct is to recoil from this call, to hide our faces from the flame. The riots and turmoil, or what I would call uprisings, that we are witnessing all around us, these are indeed difficult to comprehend. We are tempted to look away and flee to our little safe and insulated corners of the world, to bury our heads in books. We are tempted to look away and flee. But when we do that, when we try to get out of this world unscathed, we miss the way God acts in the world. We miss that the Spirit moves not through our preconceived plans or proper ways of doing things, but through a radical openness to the unexpected. Following the flame is a dangerous thing. It is a vulnerable thing. In our white world of trouble, there is so much fear of the possibility of justice precisely because this possibility represents the end of the world, or at least the end of the world as we know it. This is why there are so many projects and interests that exist for no other reason than controlling and shutting down the possibility of real justice. the powers of state violence and white supremacy that underwrite so much of American society in all of its racist, sexist, anti-immigrant, anti-queer and trans, and anti-poor scope. It is these powers that the justice of God makes tremble as it calls us to resist and indeed burn down. Such justice calls us to produce the conditions in which other worlds of possibility, other worlds of joy, and other worlds of belonging become possible. And so, when the time comes, like it did for Moses, when we are called to it, in whatever unexpected form it might take, may we have rehearsed such a commitment to an untamed openness and belonging and justice enough to put ourselves on the line as the flames rise up into the revolutionary movement of protest, marches, organized political action, and civil disobedience. As Baldwin bids us, may we dare everything in our expectation of a new and just world to come.